Welcome to the Hidden History Podcast with me, Paul Christian.
According to Hungarian mythology, a gigantic and terrifying mythical bird of prey led them to what is now their capital, Budapest. The symbol of the previously nomadic horse lords, called the Turul, was said to have dropped a sword from its talons where Budapest stands today. The word Turul is thought to have a Turkic origin, and the Magyars, or Hungarians, were once neighbours of the Turkic tribes in Central Asia before they migrated to the Carpathian Basin at the turn of the 9th and 10th centuries. From this base, the Hungarians raided deep into Western Europe as far as France and Spain, and instilled equal fear among the inhabitants as Viking raiders from the north did. Before leading them to their homeland, the Turul was said to have acted as a protector to the Magyars. One such myth recounts how eagles, emblematic of the Pecheneks, nomadic Turkic rivals of the Magyars, attacked their horses, and the Turul swooped in to save them. The Turul is also thought to have been the clan symbol of the powerful ruling house of Arpad. Following the alleged dropping of the blade, the Magyars have now made the area their home for more than 1,000 years. Hungary's first king, István, or Stephen, was a heroic figure who unified the formerly semi-nomadic Uralic raiding horse tribes of the Magyars into the unified Christian kingdom of Hungary when he was crowned in around 1000. But people are often more complicated than that, and this soldier of Christ was involved in some shocking and unforgivable acts against members of his own family. He also suffered great disappointment and left the fledgling country in chaos. The monarch was born as Vyk in around 975, son of the chieftain Geza. Geza nominally converted to Christianity following the religion's introduction to the Magyar territory in the Carpathian Basin by Byzantine and Bulgarian missionaries. Before this conversion, the Magyars followed an entirely pagan religion, which had elements of Tengrism, Shamanism and Animism, consistent with both Turkic and Mongolian steppe tribes, and the Magyars' closely related Siberian kin, the Khanty and Mansi. Tengrism, as in the worship of Tengri, can be seen as similar to the older Indo-European sky god Deus, known to the Greeks as Zeus, and the Proto-Italic as Jus Pater, or Sky Father, which morphed into Jupiter among the Latin-speaking Romans. Tengrism was influenced by Eastern religions such as Zoroastrianism from the Persians in modern-day Iran and other more exotic faiths such as Hinduism and Buddhism. The Hungarian origin myth is also similar to that of their one-time Central Asian neighbours, the Huns and Scythians. Common beliefs and practices in Hungarian paganism included human sacrifice, ancestor cults, the worship of sacred trees and springs, and the belief that leading figures were descended from animals. Religious diviner figures, akin to wizards, would attempt to manipulate the elements with magical items such as so-called rainmaker stones. Despite Stephen's conversion, his young kingdom had not seen the last of these older beliefs. The king had already had to fight off a rival, Koppany, and his pagan horde to ascend to the throne in the first place. Stephen defeated Koppany at Veszprém in 997 or 998. The defeated would-be ruler faced a grisly end after either being killed in battle or in his duchy in the southern region of Transdanubia. His body was cut into 4 pieces, which were hung on the walls of the 4 major strongholds in the kingdom, Győr, Veszprém, Esztergom, and Gyulafehervár. The conflict and brutal destruction of Koppany, who was a fellow member of the powerful Arpad dynasty, and denial of his previous rights via pagan custom to rulership, meant the new kingdom was born amid a festering schism. That untreated fissure would continue throughout Stephen's reign and long after his death. Another time when the king used exemplary violence to quell support for the old ways lay in the treatment of another perceived threat to his throne. The monarch was said to have occupied his uncle Gyula the Younger's territory in Transylvania, seized Gyula and his family, and forcibly converted them and the entire area. Tragically, Stephen outlived his children and left no heir. This meant the primary claimant to the throne was his cousin Vasil, who it was suspected had pagan leanings. As a result, Stephen overlooked Vasil's claim and nominated his sister's son, Peter Orseolo, a Venetian, as his designated heir. Not content with disinheriting Vasil, what happened next would mark Stephen, perhaps driven by grief over not having a son and heir, or through his fundamentalist devotion to his faith, as a ruthless and cruel monarch once again. Vasil was captured, blinded, and had his ears filled with molten lead, and his 3 sons, Levente, Andrew, and Bela, were driven out and expelled from the kingdom. There are competing accounts of the reason for this atrocity, with some suggesting Vasil was part of a conspiracy and failed putsch against the king. After Stephen's death in August 1038, his kingdom was riven for decades with invasions, civil wars and pagan uprisings. The turbulence was ended in 1077 when Wesel's grandson, Ladislaus, also of the Arpad dynasty, became king. He restored order through gratuitous violence and maintained property rights with mutilation and death for criminals. Despite the bloodshed, however, the Kingdom of Hungary was born. In 1526, the Battle of Mohács, around 130 miles south of Budapest, would lead to the destruction of Hungary as an independent kingdom and its partition between warring empires and religions. And it would also lead to a very odd ritual, but more on that later. The military disaster also cost the country its king and precipitated the pillage of Buda Castle and its surroundings. The battle saw the defending forces of Hungarian King Louis II ranged against the invading Ottomans under the command of Suleiman the Magnificent on August 26, 1526. The Ottoman cavalry caught the Hungarian army in a deadly pincer movement, while Ottoman cannons and Janissary musketeers pulverised the Hungarian centres, heavily armoured knights and infantry. King Louis was also the sovereign of Croatia and Bohemia, but the Ottoman victory would see his kingdom ripped apart. Louis did not live to see it, however, as the 20-year-old king died while attempting to retreat. He fell backwards off his horse while trying to traverse a steep ravine. He tumbled into a stream and drowned under the weight of his armour. The death of the king, who did not leave an heir, meant his titles passed to the omnipotent Habsburgs. The Ottoman victory led to the partition of Hungary between them and Austria. The Ottomans gained suzerainty over the nominally autonomous region of Transylvania, while the Austrians gained western Hungary and the remnants of the Kingdom of Croatia, as well as Bohemia, as the Hungarian kingdom was expunged and consumed piecemeal by rival regional hegemons. The victorious Turks entered and pillaged Buda Castle and its environs before leaving the area in ruins and retreating to safer territory. They would later return to fully occupy the city. The Ottoman Empire retained control over Hungarian territory until 1699, when they were eventually driven out by the Habsburgs. But as I mentioned earlier, Hungary's defeat could have led to a very strange ritual. The potentially pagan-influenced ritual of Buso Jarash, which takes part in Central Europe and in particular Hungary, but also parts of Serbia and Croatia. The annual celebration is part of the traditions of the South Slavic Sokci people in Mohács, Hungary, and involves dressing up in fearsome hairy horned beast costumes in February in the run-up to Ash Wednesday. There is more than one theory about the origin of the practice. One dates back to the time of the occupation of the area by Ottoman Turkish forces in the abortive 1687 campaign, rather than the more successful earlier invasion by Suleiman the Magnificent in 1526. As the Sultan's troops approached, the locals were said to have abandoned the town and fled to woodland and swamp areas. According to legend, they were encamped one night by a fire when an elderly man approached and entreated them, "Don't be afraid, your lives will soon turn to good and you'll return to your homes. Until that time, prepare for the battle, carve various weapons and scary masks for yourselves, and wait for a stormy night when a masked knight will come to you." The mysterious messenger then disappeared, but the townsfolk followed his orders. Later, on the predicted stormy night, the promised knight arrived and, as instructed, the refugees donned their costumes, took up their arms and returned to Mohács in a loud reconquest of the town. Alarmed by the incursion, it was the Ottomans' turn to flee in terror, believing that they were under attack by demons. Another, earlier version of the story holds that the Buzos, as the costumed host became known, were attempting to shoo away winter itself rather than the Turkish invaders. The latter, more primal version of the story has similarities with other Slavic traditions, such as the Balkan Koledari's Koledovane dance, which is still enacted in neighbouring Bulgaria in December and involves energetic dancing, loud chanting and the playing of instruments by costume participants to scare away supernatural winter entities like werewolves, ghosts and vampires, and more generally, winter itself. Buzo's masks are also similar in appearance to the Bavarian and Austrian myth of Krampus. Belief in the demonic horned anthropomorphized goat character is also a tradition in Hungary and some other Central European countries. The terrifying creature is said to punish children who have misbehaved in the period before Christmas. He is a companion and dark mirror of St. Nicholas, who it is said rewards well-behaved children. But whatever its true origins, the Buso Yarash remains a fascinating folkloric tradition. The mummified fist of a 1,000-year-old saint king sits inside an ornate golden reliquary. This is perhaps the main draw within the spectacular Basilica of St. Stephen in Budapest. The fist belongs to Stephen or István, the first king of the Christian Kingdom of Hungary. Each year on August the 20th, the Holy Rite, as it's called, is taken out and leads a parade on St. Stephen's Day. István was canonized in 1083. And, as part of a highly ritualized process, his body, which had been quite dead for 45 years, was dug up from its crypt. It was then that, as the legend goes, it was discovered his right arm was in a remarkable state of preservation, as if it had just been buried. The arm was then cut off and preserved as a holy relic. Despite its veneration in Hungary, the fist has not always resided in the country, a fact due to the country's often turbulent history. In the 13th century, during an invasion by Mongols, it was spirited away to Dubrovnik in Croatia to be guarded by Dominican monks. Around this time, it is likely the relic was divided into two, with the hand being chopped off. It is then believed the upper portion was sent to Lemberg, now known as Lviv, and the lower part going to the Austrian capital, Vienna. In 1771, the fist was seized by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, following an order by Habsburg Empress Maria Theresa, whose ornate tomb in Vienna's Kaisergruft, or Imperial Crypt, is seen here. The Holy Rite was taken to Schönbrunn Palace before it was eventually returned to Hungary. Then it left again as fighting on the front of World War II reached Budapest in 1944. It was taken back to Austria in the custody of the Archbishop of Salzburg. On August the 20th, 1945, a US Army priest returned the hand to Budapest. Processions then took place on August the 20th until they were banned by the anti-church communist regime. In 1989, following the fall of communism in Hungary, the processions began again and have taken place ever since. So what is it like to visit the mummified hand? Well, first one is struck by the awe-inspiring classical-style exterior of the Basilica of St. Stephen. Venture inside and you're treated to the embellished golden ceiling and vaulting dome with an image of God himself surrounded by saints and angels. This is held up by neoclassical pillars in varying shades of marble topped with gold. Beautiful portraits and ornate flourishes decorate almost every inch of this wonderful building, and then you see it. Housed in what looks like a miniature golden glass church of its own is the Holy Rite, the clenched fist of King St. Stephen himself. Greenish-grey in colour and resembling a leather glove. It was smaller than I imagined, but no less impressive a sight, bedecked with gold leaf and jewels and resting on a crimson cushion. You can just about make out the thumbnail, or at least the cuticle, and you can see some flaking of the tightly clenched knuckle. At the base of the reliquary are angels rendered in gold, and beneath are various heraldic symbols. I've been to some odd relics in churches, but this must be the strangest, but it is not a macabre sight. It has a potency and a power, albeit expressed silently and somewhat defiantly. A notice says that the Holy Rite is highly esteemed, and it is not difficult to see why. It is a must-see if you ever visit Budapest. A longish walk down Kiraly Street from the centre of Budapest to the suburbs, which house international embassies and other crumbling but palatial buildings, is worthwhile to reach a very curious castle. En route, there is also an interesting example of communist architecture in relief on the outside of a brutalist building that serves as a palate cleanser for an earlier, but not as early as it looks, citadel. The structure in question is the Vajdahunyad Castle, which is situated in the centre of Budapest's city park, past an intriguingly designed ethnography museum, as a mishmash of architectural styles collide in this historically layered city. The castle is a relatively modern copy of Hunyad Castle, or Corvin Castle in Hunedoara, Romania. It was built as part of the Millennial Exhibition in 1896 that marked 1,000 years since the Magyars conquered their homeland of the Carpathian Basin in 895 AD. The Hunyad Castle in Transylvania was once part of the historic Kingdom of Hungary, and the copy was made by Ignác Alpár. It features a number of different architectural styles from a range of time periods, including Romanesque, Gothic, Renaissance and Baroque. Essentially a large folly, it was originally constructed from cardboard and wood, but the locals loved the new feature so much that it was rendered in more permanent stone and brick between 1904 and 1908. The building and its surroundings have a number of interesting features, not least a stone bust of Bela Lugosi, the Hungarian-American actor who played Count Dracula in the original 1931 film adaptation of Bram Stoker's famous novel. It is thought the Lugosi bust was added because Stoker's inspiration for Count Dracula, Vlad Tepes, Prince of Wallachia, otherwise known as Vlad the Impaler, was held captive in the original Transylvanian castle. There is also a creepy hooded statue of the mysterious Anonymous Bele Regis Notarius, or Anonymous, notary of King Bela. Anonymous was a chronicler of a Hungarian king, most likely Bela III, who reigned from 1148 to 1196. It is a matter of scholarly debate who the mystery man was, and no definitive answer has been found. He is credited with penning the Gesta Hungarorum, or Deeds of the Hungarians, which was written in medieval Latin in around 1200 AD. As is often the case with such statues, part of it, in this case the stylus in his right hand, is worn shiny from countless visitors rubbing it, presumably for luck. Today, perhaps bizarrely, Vajdahunyad Castle is home to the Museum of Hungarian Agriculture. Whilst I'm sure Hungarian agriculture is a fascinating topic, I was short on time, so did not visit the museum itself. The castle grounds also include the intricate and pleasant Yak Chapel, which I peered inside, though would definitely visit in more depth if I had more time. Near to the castle is Heroes Square, which features statues of the seven chieftains of the Magyars and other historical representations. All are certainly worth that walk from the centre of the city. Welcome to the epicentre of extremism, repression and shocking mistreatment of political dissidents in Budapest. This is the infamous House of Terror in Andrássy-Utca, close to the centre of the Hungarian capital, on the Pest side of the Danube. It first became notorious during the dying embers of World War II when the ultra-nationalist Arrow Cross Party, founded by Ferenc Szalasi, took up residence after they formed a government in Hungary from the 15th of October 1944 to the 28th of March 1945. The party constructed a dank dungeon in the basement of the building to house its victims. Under the Arrow Cross regime, 10 to 15,000 people were eliminated outright and 80% deported. The regime was overthrown following the Axis defeat in the war. However, the terror would not end for Hungary or for the imposing building at No. 60 Andrássy Street. The Soviet Union, via its Hungarian supporters, then occupied the building. When they saw the basement, evidently rather than being repulsed, they saw potential. In particular, the feared AVH secret police, which were similar to the Soviet KGB, set up operations in the basement. In scenes reminiscent of George Orwell's infamous Room 101 from the novel 1984, they installed a variety of cruel cells that were used to break the wills of their political opponents. During the Soviet era, the building's upper floors were occupied by office staff, with desks still in situ for visitors to observe and wonder how many knew of the horrors that were perpetrated beneath their feet. The modern museum iteration features a T-54 tank in the centre court area, with pictures of victims and propaganda posters surrounding it. And outside the building is a section of the Berlin Wall and a physical artistic rendering of the Iron Curtain that, in 1946, Winston Churchill said had descended across Europe, dividing the continent along ideological lines. Inside the edifice, in the middle section, is a collection of communist posters and looped footage of speeches and propaganda films with the obligatory rapturous applause. An installation is devoted to the victims of oppression by political extremes, with a strong visual representation of the persecution of religious devotion during the Soviet era. But, as alluded to previously, it is the basement that provides the starkest glimpse into the heinous history of this building. But before you get there is a portentous horror show to view first. Access to the subterranean dungeon is gained via one of the slowest elevators imaginable, rendered in black marble and dark glass and in gloomy and foreboding lighting. Whilst in the lift, visitors are played interviews given by seemingly unabashed former members of the AVH, who acted as jailers and executioners to the dissidents in their captivity. Perhaps it was the wording of the English translation, but the sheer inhumanity of the men's testimony is haunting in its brutal honesty, matter-of-factness and deadpan delivery. They spoke of how they would give the condemned a bit of extra dinner the night before they would face their end, and how they simply tore up their final letters to loved ones rather than seeing that they were delivered. It was as if the condemned were just being unpersoned and rubbed out, which, on reflection, they were. On reaching the basement, the featureless monotone concrete and musty air are the first impressions one gets. As your eyes adjust, you start to realise what these rooms are. They're not just prison cells, they are fiendishly designed nightmares made real, and with the sole intention of breaking people and making them confess to some unknown or undefined crime against the regime. They come in different shapes and sizes, quite literally. There is a horrifying, narrow, upright coffin-sized cell that, with the thick door closed, is impossible to sit or even crouch down in. I stood inside and instantly felt a wave of claustrophobia. How long were the victims kept in this, I hesitate to even call a room. To make matters worse, there was an intense eye-level lamp that was hideously bright and burned your eyes with no possibility of relief. There was also a cell where you were unable to stand or even sit upright. The blind panic and nausea must have been all-encompassing. Another dungeon was able to be filled with freezing water up to the waist, so sitting, laying or sleeping were impossible. This was a selection of chambers designed to create utter hell for the inmates. And even the standard cells were horrible, sparse, dark, soul-destroying and inescapable. They had just a tiny bed pushed up against the dank and damp wall and a table bolted to the floor. I heard a guide from an official city tour whose parents remembered the horror of the communist regime in Budapest, and she said that no actual executions took place inside the basement, but a genuine and extremely crude gallows was placed inside one of the concrete rooms, which is genuine and was used who knows how many times. No set of gallows are a pleasant sight, but this contraption was something far more sinister than the traditional scaffold you've seen in movies. This instrument of death consisted of a long wooden block with a rope on the top. I was told that the condemned would be marched in, their conviction read out to them, then they'd mount a bucket, chair or other basic platform which would be kicked away by one of the executioners as another simultaneously pulled the other end of the rope. The monstrous corner cutting struck me with this device. For me it crystallised the othering and dehumanisation of the condemned. So insignificant they'd been rendered, their captors barely even bothered to give them a professional execution. The final part of the visit features a wall of names and faces, but these were not victims of repression. The open-ended date next to the pictures of some of these people alludes to that. No, these were and are, for some of them are still alive, those who had been somehow part of the apparatus that had maintained the monstrous communist regime. A strange and beautiful location that was once home to a mysterious hermit is now the site of an incredible church with a tragic history. This is the intriguing Cave Church of Budapest. The site, which is now officiated by Pauline monks, is housed inside of Gellert Hill on the Buda side of the Danube. The Gellert Hill cave is part of a cavernous network within Gellert Hill. It has a legendary origin story, as it is also referred to as St. Ivan's Cave after the hermit, who supposedly lived here and performed miracles using the natural thermal water to heal the sick in Lourdes-like ceremonies. It is likely the geothermal waters fed the pools of the old Sharosh Furdo, or muddy baths, now known as Gellert baths. Its documented history began in the 19th century when a family lived there in a small brick house at the opening of the cave. This is recorded in a painting by Mihaly Mayer, which was made sometime in the 1860s, and a photograph by Georgi Klos, dated to 1877. The first modern entrance for the cave was constructed in the 1920s by a group of Pauline monks who were inspired by similar places of worship on a pilgrimage to Lourdes in France. After its consecration in 1926, the site was a chapel and a monastery until the heavy and atheistic hand of the Soviet regime came crashing down on the cave church in 1951. But more on that shortly. Prior to this, the site was used by German troops in World War II as a field hospital. After the Axis defeat in 1945, the Soviet Red Army captured Budapest, but the church continued to function for 6 years. It was then, in 1951, that the communist authorities launched a brutal crackdown as part of a wider assault on the Catholic Church. The entire Pauline order was arrested on Easter Monday by the State Protection Authority and charged with treason. The head monk, Ferenc Weser, was executed and the rest were sent to forced labour camps for around 10 years. The church was then sealed behind an 8-foot concrete wall. After the fall of the communist regime in 1989, the wall was smashed down and the cave reopened. By 1992, the chapel had been fully restored and the Pauline order had returned, picking up where they left off in a final victory over those that had repressed them. They continue to perform their religious functions at the cave to the present. Today, the walls of the inner sanctum are all made from concrete, designed to look like an authentic cave. Despite the now artificial interior, the site is home to some intriguing features. One of these is a miraculous relic in the form of a replica of the Black Madonna of Shestakova. Black Madonnas are representations of the Virgin Mary and could be paintings or statues that have mysteriously turned black. They are said to be the conduits for miracles, with one being said to have saved the church from fire. Whilst the interior is a veritable treasure trove, the outside area also has some interesting features. There is a turreted neo-Gothic facade, which is similar architecturally to the nearby Fisherman's Bastion, which lies further up the hill. And the ever-present figure of King St. Stephen, or Istvan, is present outside the entrance to the cave, as a statue serves as a silent guardian standing beside his horse. That's it for this video. Don't forget to like, share, and most importantly, subscribe. And you can also support the channel on Subscribestar via the link in the description. Thanks for watching. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Hidden History Podcast with me, Paul Christian. Don't forget to rate and subscribe and share.